Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Thanks to Jenny Green, it's Thursday the 30th of September and this is Game On. Coming up today with his future as Irish manager still on the line, Stephen Kenny names his latest squad.
When I go around the country or travel to airports, that's what I experience, people saying, listen, you know, we'd live what you're doing, and you know, it's exciting and we want to be a part of it, and we want to, you know, so I feel that excitement throughout, you know, throughout Ireland.
In boxing, an independent review names the suspicious decisions at the Rio Olympics. Not that it will surprise Michael Conlon.
Goggin, that's a global kick.
My dream's been shattered now, but you know what? I have a big career ahead of me. And Neeson's, they're known for being cheats. Amateur boxing stinks from the core right to the top. I'm gutted from the bottom of my heart. I wanted to go back with a gold medal to Ireland. Now I feel like I'm going back like a loser. No, I'm not a loser, I'm a winner.
Bernard Jackman is in studio to preview the next round of the URC after the welcome return of fans and familiar faces.
Goggin, that's the global kick through. Zeebo's after it, so too is Ahern. How quick is Thomas Ahern? He might get there first. Zeebo is, and Zeebo touches down to finish off the rout.
What a way to finish the game for Zeebo. A try after 3 or 4 minutes, backed up by another one in the 79th minute. Munster's record try scorer of all time, but he's added two more tonight.
Plus, we have Champions League to review and Jeff Shepherd on Tom Brady's return to Gillette Stadium.
Game on 2FM.
If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. Now, as you all should know by now, FIFA 22 launches worldwide tomorrow. FIFA 22 delivers the most realistic, fluid and responsive football experience, unlocking the raw emotion, passion and physicality of the world's game. To celebrate its release, we have a copy of FIFA 22 for PS5 to give away every day this week to our listeners here on Game On. All you have to do to be in with a chance to win is answer the following question. Which player scored a last-minute winner for Manchester United last night? So text your answer and name to 51552 and the winner will be announced at the end of the show. I'm delighted to say that I am joined in studio by journalist David Snaid. David, you're also a Manchester United fan, so you must have been pretty relieved on the 94th minute, was it, last night, when Ronaldo once again found the back of the net.
Fergie time. Back in the day, isn't it now?
All a time now, I'd say, at this stage, because there's been so many of them.
Oh, well, it seems to be that Ferguson was the one who got Ronaldo back to Old Trafford, so you kind of have to still call it Fergie time. Yeah, it's an odd one. I suppose, like, anyone watching that game, obviously, results are the thing that matter, but it's kind of difficult to get too excited when you kind of see what happened in the preceding 90-odd minutes, because it was definitely a game where Villarreal totally outwitted Manchester United and should have been, I put up to you, could have been 3 or 4 goals up at half time. If you're looking at it coming back when you go down with about half an hour to go and then getting the win, like that says a lot about the character in the team, and it's one of the aspects that obviously Solskjaer was talking about when Ronaldo was coming back and getting that mentality into the team, because pretty much since Ferguson has left it hasn't really been there. There was this period maybe where it looked as if obviously Jose Mourinho seemed to be instilling that, won a couple of trophies, but obviously Jose did what Jose does and it didn't last long with United and things disintegrated. But I don't think too many people would be getting carried away with what's happening with Manchester United at the moment, just because even with some of the results they're getting, which is still impressive in terms of digging out those results, where they're actually at performance wise and you look at what else is happening around Europe and in the Premier League, still strikes that they could be a little bit off.
So what could he have done that was different? He did try a new formation. So we're used to him playing that 4-2-3-1 and you decided to go with the 4-3-3 and just have one holding midfield player. And, you know, on paper you think, OK, let's give this a go. But it just didn't seem to work. So the fact that it hasn't worked and his 4-2-3-1 hasn't worked that well either, like, what are his options now?
Yeah, well, it's one of them where over, you look over what happens with United whenever they do play with those two sitting midfielders like Fred and Scott McTominay. Obviously, Scott McTominay coming back into the side, having been injured. If it's not McTominay or Fred, it could be Matic, could be in there as well. People talking about Donny van de Beek coming into the squad, but I think his future looks very uncertain. Now you've seen the reaction from him as well when he wasn't even getting brought on. Kind of bit of dissent by throwing his chewing gum away on the subs bench. But I just think if you're looking at it from the point of view of what's happening with United and the players, they've got such an array of attacking players. Like even like Marcus Rashford still has to come back in. Anthony Martial seems totally out of the fray at the moment now as well. So it's about getting a bit of a balance with the midfield. And it kind of strikes me as strange to say, considering that Villarreal even deservedly won the Europa League final, beat Manchester United, but it almost struck me that maybe there was a small bit of disrespect shown to them coming to Old Trafford by only playing with one sitting midfielder, because you saw him deal with the times that United were just cut to absolute bits on the counter-attack, and not even just on the counter-attack, but just being totally dominated in midfield. And for all the signings that have been made, and obviously all the excitement around Cristiano Ronaldo coming back, and listen, it is a bit of think about from where he was, obviously, and what he achieved with United, and then going off and coming back, like he's held in such regard with the United fans. And it looked as if they got someone in like Jadon Sancho, who hasn't really lit things up at the moment. It's clear that he's going to take a bit of time to settle in. And then you have Raphael Varane, who's just like, he's a Rolls Royce of a defender and so much experience. And you're not going to be able to shore up every single problem in one summer. It seemed as if they actually had got a couple of problems sorted, but what's become clear and has been evident for some time is just the midfield is not good enough. And when over the course of a season you'll be able to patch it up in certain games, and there's been games where Fred and McTominay have been man of the match against Manchester City, and they've been man of the match against Liverpool. But that's all well and good doing it in certain big games and turning up, but it's having that ability to do it over the course of a whole season, and that's where the question marks are with United, and also with Solskjaer. Like, saw someone making the point, and it's actually a very, really good one, that he's done so much good work in terms of ridding the squad of some dead wood and some players with bad attitudes, that he deserves a lot of credit for that. Now he's gotten in a group of players who on paper should be able to challenge. So now the demands are on the manager to actually make that squad capable of challenging. So far, when you look at them in the top four, only a point off the top, it's clear that they've had a good start to the season in comparison to other years. It's now going to be a case of, as was mentioned earlier, will they be able to do it over the course of a year? Attacking wise, at the top end of the pitch, you would say, remember the great Newcastle team under Kevin Keegan, the entertainers, where the other team scored three, they'd score four. You kind of get the sense that could be where it's at with United, even though they have got some good defenders, just because there's still so many problems, gaping problems in the middle of the park that haven't been solved. And it's clear as well that the players that they have got there, unless they do step up, are going to be found to be wanting again this season.
On a positive, David De Gea was very impressive, but that is probably reflective of the poor performance of the people around him, that he needed to be so good. But that is something that is that does bode well for the season ahead. What about Chelsea, though? Look, I think as well, a lot of the chat heading into the Juventus game was that they were struggling since Ronaldo had left, but they were able to pull it together last night. Was it a case that Juventus were really good, or were just Chelsea starting to wane a little bit after their impressive start to the season?
I suppose, well, the fact, look at when the goal came, like 10 seconds into the second half, an unbelievable strike as well by Chiesa, who everyone saw at the Euros. It's always one of them where, even though he's obviously been doing it for Juventus before that, when you see a player like that just like shine at the Euros, it kind of brings him into focus for everyone else, and that was just a tremendous goal. That obviously caught them on the hop. Like, Tuchel was very interesting in terms of talking about kind of trying to bounce back after the Man City game, and considering where Chelsea had been at, to see them completely dominated by City was a surprise. It's not a surprise to see City do that to a team, even a major rival, because they are so good and have players who are doing that. But from where Tuchel has managed to have got Chelsea, obviously European champions, went on a serious run domestically and just seemed to be totally overpowering teams, that was a real surprise to see them. Kind of really, it was probably the first time that Tuchel was caught out really tactically in a duel like that. you kind of gave the players a day off after that game. You kind of wanted to give them a kind of chance to kind of maybe reflect on it a little bit and just lick their wounds and rest. And he spoke about the fact that in training and for the 2 days before the game that they seemed re-energised and refocused, but they just still lacked any kind of attacking cohesion. It was probably one of the aspects of last season and on the great run that they did go on when he came in, that they just seem to be very economical in what they do. Like, they don't, even though they can dominate teams, they don't blow them away with creating loads of chances and absolutely like blitzing teams like in an exciting way. But even how they do control games is exciting in its own sense, and just kind of the tactical way he goes about it. Obviously, we're bringing in Lukaku for an amazing amount of money, considering like the improvements he's made in the game. Like, there was times where he would have been playing. I remember chatting to Leon Osman for an article that I was doing recently, and Leon Osman was saying how he can train, and they used to just go around and actually like lash balls into him just to try and improve his first touch, like, just because we're like, he has everything apart from the fact that a lot of the time his second touch was a tackle, and he was doing his teammates' heads in, and like he'd be taking it on him to the point where he'd normally give a normal pass into someone else, but when he came to Lukaku, he always wanted to make sure that he was giving it a bit extra to try and improve him. And the strides he's made in his game at Inter Milan under Conte, and you've seen it for Belgium again, it's just incredible. And he made such an impressive start to things at Chelsea. Last couple of games have been a dip, but probably to be expected a little bit. You're still feeling your way in. Like, it's almost as if because of the money that's involved in football now, you expect lads to come in and just be absolutely sensational, unreal, and play amazing in every game. Like, it doesn't work like that. You know, sometimes you do actually just have to scrap a 1-0 here and there, or just like get through a game and just like keep on working for your team. And I think he kind of did that, but I think they only had like, was it one shot on target in the game, which is like, even though you're going away to Juventus, you kind of expect more from the European champions. Like, they've got a home game, isn't it, now, I think, against Southampton in the Premier League at the weekend. And small part of me, because like, people remember Lukaku, he's kind of one of those kind of streak strikers where he could go maybe 10-11 games, he might not even have a shot, he might not score, but then once he gets that one goal, he could go on a massive streak and just score constantly. So because of what's happened in the last couple of weeks, I'm really tempted to take him out and be fancy football team, because I'm just thinking, ooh, I need some a bit more reliable.
That's a very bold statement. Right, we are going to be coming back to football in a little bit, because Stephen Kenny named his Republic of Ireland squad for the Qatar friendly and the Azerbaijan game. But now we are going to turn our attention to boxing. And if you're listening at the top of the show, would have heard Michael Conlon's interview after the 2016 Olympics in Rio. There were a lot of question marks over the results, and now there are answers to what happened in Rio. So there was an independent investigation, and it found that a system to manipulate the outcome of boxing matches by officials was in place at that Olympic Games, and the fights that were included in this have been named, and Michael Conlon's fight is one of them. To go through all of this, we are joined on the line by journalist Chris McNulty. But first, let's hear from Michael Conlon. He was speaking on Drive Time a little bit earlier.
Yeah, well, you know, I hope so. I've seen people message me and stuff on Twitter and stuff, and saying like, you should just throw the medal in the bin. But I would never do that, because the Olympic medal is an Olympic medal. Even albeit it won't be gold, because like, who knows what would happen in the next two bouts. It will be a bronze medal, and I would take it and I would cherish it forever, like I do my one from 2012, because an Olympic medal is something that not many people will ever get to achieve. And I believe they should have two by now. I believe I should be Olympic champion, but I should definitely have two. Mm-hmm. So I would love it. And my hope that this, after this report coming out, which I didn't expect, it came out of the blue for me, and I only seen it all appear on Twitter yesterday, and it actually has rekindled like a bit of hope for, you know, things to be changed around, the media kind of get that medal.
So that's Mick Conlon there speaking about his chance of getting a Rio bronze medal. Look, who knows what is going to happen. Chris McNulty joins us now. Chris, I think the report probably didn't surprise too many, just given everything that happened in Rio and since then. I'm not sure if it's going to provide much solace, though, to those involved.
No, probably not. I think, you know, the findings of the report, they're quite staggering indeed, but they're not surprising, I suppose, to anyone who has really followed the story over the last 5 years. I mean, even going back into the run-up to those games in Rio, I mean, there were allegations of what was going to come down the line. You know, I mean, senior figures within the sport at the time had warned that sort of all sorts of malpractice was going on behind the scenes. Those warnings sort of went unheeded at the time, and then we rolled into the games and what happened with a number of high-profile fights, including that bantamweight quarterfinal involving Mick Conlon. You know, it was really, I suppose everyone at the time had their suspicions. I mean, you know, Mick wasn't out of the ring until he had made his feelings known to Aiba and the officials concerned. But I suppose, you know, it was interesting listening to Mick there. I mean, that was a medal bout. It was a fight to get Michael Conlon or Vladimir Nikitin onto the podium. And you just don't know what would have happened thereafter. I mean, I suppose we can maybe assume or presume now that an Olympic medal may be winging its way to Michael Conlon in due course once this this investigation has reached its complete conclusion in the coming months. It may not, I suppose, provide much solace, but I mean, if Michael Conlon does maybe get that Olympic medal, I mean, 5, maybe 6 years on, it may not hold as much meaning as it would have done back at the time. But I suppose, you know, it would put his name on that roll of honour again, you know, for a second time.
Yeah, that's for sure. And it can never be taken away from him. Well, it can never again be taken away from him is probably a better way of putting it. So Professor Richard McLaren was the head of the investigation that was committed by the AIBA. And he said that the seeds had been sown years before. That's quite worrying, really, when you think about it. If it was something that had been put in place or plans put in place for that to happen in the lead up to this, and it seems from, you know, just I guess anecdotal evidence that people knew this was going to happen as well.
Absolutely. I mean, like he finds quite clearly that, you know, Rio was sort of was the end game, if you like, but there were essentially what were practice tournaments. I mean, the qualifying tournaments that, you know, boxers would have engaged in were essentially where certain officials and certain referees and judges and leading officials within the sport, within AIBA, were basically practicing this corruption and the manipulation of bouts that was going to sort of determine the course of medals at the Olympic Games in Rio. And, you know, one of the findings, he says, at the Olympic qualifiers, the manipulation methodology was fine-tuned in anticipation for Rio. So while boxers were fine-tuning their own preparations for the Olympic Games, behind the scenes, there were things being fine-tuned that were ultimately going to cost boxers like Michael Conlon. And, you know, some of the findings I found really, you know, just staggering in terms of the language used to sort of describe it. I mean, and there's one thing in particular that stands out, where one of the bouts in 2016 was the subject of a six-figure bribe offer and a figure of $250,000 mentioned to fix a lightweight semi-final. Now, in the end, no bribe was paid, but that certainly doesn't take away from the fact that a six-figure sum was an offer and all sorts of different practices involved. And you just wonder, I mean, he does, Professor McLaren, allude to the fact that these practices were essentially in place back as far as the run-up to the 2012 Olympic Games in London. And, you know, you go back over Marie maybe the last 20, 25 years and even beyond, and look at the Olympic cycles. There's been boxing controversy at each and every Olympic Games. And now you sort of just begin to wonder what exactly was going on in the background in each of those.
It's really worrying, and it's also very concerning for the future of boxing as well. Do you think that there is any danger that it could be removed from the Olympic Games?
I think, Marie, that's a very, very real possibility. I mean, it's only last week that the International Olympic Committees, who, of course, they suspended AIBA, and it was actually the IOC who looked after boxing at the recent Tokyo Games. They had suspended them because of what was essentially going on in the background. And last week, the IOC, I'm just going to read a quote from the IOC, where they had deepest concerns in three areas: governance, finance, and referee and judging, that led to the original suspension remain unresolved. And the IOC Director General, Christopher Kepper, has actually written to AIBA demanding that several reforms are implemented. The World Championships are coming up later this year in Belgrade, and the IOC is again noting that certain reforms are still not in place. And, like, the IOC have already told AIBA and told boxing, told the boxing world that its place in the programs of the Olympic Games in Paris is under severe jeopardy. And like that was before even these findings. Now AIBA have come out and sort of welcomed the findings, and it was of course AIBA in the wake of 2016 who commissioned Professor McLaren. But you know, you really would have to worry. You know, AIBA really down to it or up to its very very top level really really has to get itself, you know, in gear, because like, you know, we've only 3 years to the next Olympic Games in Paris, and you know, there really, really isn't time to sort of dally on really serious reforms such as these.
And just in terms of consequences, so obviously it's a damning report. Some of the revelations are just mind-blowing, really, even though they're not surprising, but it is when you read them in black and white that they really hit home. What's going to be the consequences?
Well, I mean, you would imagine in terms of the affected bouts that, you know, the likes of Michael Conlon perhaps would be, you know, given a medal or whatever. But I mean, that doesn't really solve an issue for me, because, you know, boxing's a sport. I mean, there would be semi-finals and finals, so all of that's still going to be really up in the air in terms of reforms. You know, in fairness to the people that are governing the sport of boxing, there have been new systems in place whereby, you know, back in 2016, there wasn't a sort of a, you know, a random selection in terms of which referees and judges were going to certain bouts. So there's now a random selection element that has been introduced during tournaments. Also, referees, judges and officials that are going to the World Championships in Belgrade, they face, you know, certain selection criteria, background checks and a sort of variety of things that are maybe designed to at least minimise the threat of corruption. You know, we look at some of the findings here, which actually noted that referees and judges were being put into this, not even certain bouts, but there were a number of five-star referee and judges, including one, an Irishman, who were allocated to a certain judge position, I think 20 of 29 occasions that one official officiated. So we've got five ringside judges and a referee, but on 20 of 29 occasions that he officiated in the tournament, he was in the same position. So that level has at least been removed. In terms of boxing going forward, though, I mean, boxing and particularly the AIBA have serious questions to ask of its own management, of its own structure. And is it going to listen to the IOC? Is it going to actually take these findings and sort itself out before it actually gets removed from the Olympic program heading into 2024.
Right, well, it sounds like there are still a lot more questions to be answered. Chris McNulty, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to take a very quick break and then we're back talking Irish football.
Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's high-protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Game on 2FM. Welcome back to Game On. I'm Marie Crowe and I'm in the company of David Snaid. We are going to chat about Stephen Kenny's Ireland squad for the Azerbaijan game and the Qatar friendly as well. But first, let's hear from the Ireland head coach who spoke to Tony O'Donoghue a little bit earlier, starting with Seamus Coleman's absence.
Yeah, and listen, Seamus is a real loss. There's no doubt about it. I think he's been an outstanding player for Ireland and he's an exceptional captain. So he got injured he's had a problem over the last year with his hamstring. He tweaked it in the Azerbaijan game, came back and played for Everton against Burnley and re-injured it. So he's missing for quite a few weeks and hopefully he comes back fully fit, because he still has so much to give in a green shirt, you feel. Obviously Seamus didn't play against Serbia and the players that came in did really well, and it was an exceptional game against Serbia. Serbia are very good. So we're looking forward to going to Azerbaijan now, and you know, we've picked a squad that we feel we can win.
When you look back at that game, in particular the concession of the goal, a lot of lessons to be learned from that, I'm sure.
It was an exceptional strike, all right, on the night, and the timing of it wasn't great from our point of view, just the last kick before half time. But, you know, in this campaign, although it's not gone as we would have wanted, we've taken the lead in Serbia, we've taken the lead in Portugal, and we've come back late in the last two games, which is important. to score late equalisers, and that shows good spirit. But certainly, the players are determined. I thought the last international window, very good performance against Portugal, lost it in the 89th minute. Game we should have won against Azerbaijan. Serbia were better than us probably on the day against the, in at home. They're an excellent team, but we played a lot of really good stuff against Serbia, and managed to get that equaliser. So there's nothing in the games. You know, we played Portugal. It went to the last 96 minutes. Serbia both games were an exceptional team. 1-1, 3-2. So tough game. So we've got to turn our draws into wins. That's what we have to do, and that has to be the next thing for us to do.
And do you think that you're going to be judged on a result against Azerbaijan? Because there's been a lot of debate about your position rather than right. The evolution of the team.
Yeah, well, you know, I think you can't help that. But I think we're just very focused on preparing the team well. I think we want to. I think there's tremendous support right throughout the country, and that's what we feel. And that's, you know, 25,000 was half capacity in the Aviva that night. They were very, very supportive of the team against Serbia. Tremendous support. You understand the evolution of the team, the squad itself, and the change of style. And they understand that we're doing a lot of things right, and we're making mistakes as well. And we need to, as I say, we need to just get that victory in Azerbaijan. That's what we want to strive to do, and hopefully we can try and do that.
Do you think, though, that every game is almost like a national referendum on your position?
No, that doesn't concern me. It doesn't concern me. So, from my point of view, I have confidence in all of the players, and I think I see it. I'm watching them grow. We've had a radical, we've given so many players our opportunity, which is probably never happened really in the history of Irish football. I think a number of players, and that's testament to all the work being done at all the clubs throughout the country, because it's sort of very organic, from the ground up. You can see players emerging from the four parts of the country through the international teams at 15 to 21, and then coming into the senior international team. And you know, we're not claiming that we've been perfect, but there's been a lot of positive performances, and we need to then turn them into, as you say, the draws into wins, and that's what we need to do, and hopefully we can do that in this window.
We're missing some players through suspension and through injury. Dara O'Shea obviously, and Alan Brown and Jason Malumbi through suspension, but a number of players have come back from injury. And also talk to me about Will Keane of Wigan. It's his first call-up. Do you see him being involved in these games?
Yeah, Will is someone that has been watching, we've been watching for a while. He's having he had an injury that affected his last couple of seasons, and he's been very consistent this season. He's probably having his best season. Wigan are up to the other night. I was at the game on Tuesday night, and he's a forward player, second striker, who links the play, good awareness and good way to pass and good vision, and also scores some goals. Certainly he's come into the squad, and we have a few days training, which is, we're not used to that. We normally come in on a Monday and the match is Wednesday. We don't play the next Saturday, right? We've got an 8-hour flight in the middle of that, but on Wednesday, so we actually have a bit of time to prepare for this game, and we hopefully get ourselves right.
Stephen Kenny there speaking to Tony O'Donoghue a little bit earlier on. David Snay, journalist, is with me here in studio. Another Ireland squad, David. Conversation isn't moving on really, though. I think it's probably quite clear there in that interview with Tony and Stephen that the focus is still very much on Stephen Kenny's job, whether he's the right man for the job and what he can get from this team.
Yeah, I think how Tony put it there about kind of a national referendum, it's kind of a very good way of putting it, because if you're going off, obviously going off the results, and if he was just trying to get a new contract tomorrow, he wouldn't be getting one, because the results clearly haven't been good enough. And obviously he was out there earlier on today and at the FAI for the squad announcement, and obviously covering the games. And if you're looking in terms of trying to gauge that mood, I know Stephen Kenny said it there about kind of out and about and people coming up to him and stuff, but I think the biggest indication I would have got that there's a sense that people and supporters are willing to maybe give this a little bit longer was, I'd say, the last 25 minutes or so of that game against Serbia, where, especially off the back of Azerbaijan, the 1-1 draw, which was a very, very poor performance all round, and especially coming off maybe the back of, as well, having done so well against Portugal and almost nicking a really good result there, they weren't able to build that momentum. And it was a third game in what, 6 or 7 days. You're coming into the last 25 minutes or so. Serbia should have been out of sight, could have really won the game if it wasn't for Gavin Bizzuno. And the fans never kind of gave up. You know what I mean? They stuck with it a little bit, and the atmosphere in those last 20 minutes was really exceptional. It was really good. Now, that'll only get you so far, and that goodwill will only be there for so long when you're bringing through these players. And it's what you made the point, what Stephen Kenny made the point there, saying it's about turning some of these draws into victories. And even the results, say, of like a Portugal, like, it's all well and good going out there and doing really, really well and putting on a really good performance, but then when you can't back it up a couple of days later against Azerbaijan, that's when there's obviously going to be question marks coming in about, well, what's actually happening. He can point obviously to the changes that have happened and the inconsistencies there when you bring new players, but that's why the criticism comes, and that's why a lot of the criticism is fair when you're pointing to the results, and it's a results business. Kind of some of the focus seemed to have got changed on Stephen Kenny's behalf when he spoke about how obviously he was looking more to the next campaign and for the Euros, and it wasn't so much building towards this World Cup, and that was kind of a new way from the go, because it was never something that he publicly said before coming into the job, saying, right, well, we'll obviously, Ireland will do their best and try and qualify, but it's essentially building for the next campaign. That was never put out there originally. That was something that over time obviously he came out and said. So I'd say the big thing for it is backing up. You're going into a game now, and well, next week really, against Azerbaijan, and the difference being it's not as a condensed calendar of games. It's not going to be 3 games in 6 days. You kind of made that point as well, where it's pretty much all or nothing in this game. You have to go there and win the game. Like, it's as simple as that. And I think it was put to him later on today about, doesn't matter about how you play, it's just about getting the win. And like, at this point in the campaign, that's what it is about. Like, what he's trying to do in terms of change the way Ireland are trying to play and the focus, and that's, people can kind of accept that a little bit and say, well, that's clear what he's trying to do. They'll take a couple of maybe sloppy performances now, but good results, because that's what's going to buy him time, essentially, now at this point, because otherwise the criticism, rightly, is going to keep on building, because there's only so often you can say you're building and you're changing things and you're making stuff up, but after a while you're just going to get nowhere if you keep doing that. After a while you do have to settle on where you're going with it, who you're bringing through, who you're going to be focusing on. And yet, you see the squad and you see who's available from, say, the last 3 games, and it just gives you a reminder that in international football, you're never, ever, ever going to have a settled group of players or a squad even for a whole campaign. There's going to be chopping and changing, and it's how you actually react to that and how that works within the squad that's going to get you through. And if he's sending that same message out to a group of players who are coming in, that this is what we're doing, that would bode well, you would think, in terms of just that continuity, because the amount of changes and injuries that we've already seen is mad, even for the squad and who's
available. That's before you even mentioned COVID and everything that has happened in the last while too.
That was obviously a major factor early on in his reign. I think kind of the emphasis a little bit has changed, because, like, if you look at, say, the squad, the team that would have played out in Portugal and Faro, which a lot of people will say was probably Ireland's best for 89 minutes, or when was it Ronaldo scored? Yeah, 89 minutes and then the 96th minute. And, like, remember being in the stadium thinking this was a really assured performance against a team who clearly are better in terms of individuals. It wasn't just a sit back, obviously Ireland rolled their luck, but they had a purpose about them on the counter-attack and how they were playing that was really impressive. And but you go through that team, and even since then, and you've got like Darragh O'Shea, who started that game, he's out now for 6 months with a fractured ankle. You've got Seamus Coleman, who's going to miss this game because of a hamstring injury. He kind of soldiered through the rest of that campaign but has been struggling. Like, Jeff Hendricks played 5 minutes of Premier League football since coming back to Newcastle United. Josh Cullen, seems to be the star, and he seems to be the one now who's the main midfielder for Ireland in terms of even that performance and what he did against Serbia too. Like, he's playing week in, week out for Anderlecht and seems to be improving. Like, Matt Doherty, I'm not sure if the sports team is out for later, but like, he's only played in the Conference League. He hasn't kicked a ball in the Premier League since the last get-together, and that was his most impressive showing for Ireland in terms of the cover that he was given defensively, but also getting forward. But these are the issues. This is what international managers have to deal with. Maybe not so much at the top level, because the players will generally obviously be playing, but at the lower level, where Ireland, where we are, it's about getting a tune out of players who maybe aren't going to be playing every week, and that's what he now has to do. And
it gives opportunity as well, though. And look, somebody like Will Keane coming in there, a big surprise. So yeah, he's had 4 goals in the opening 9 matches of the League One season with Wigan, and as Stephen said, he was there watching him the other night, so he clearly impressed, and now is his chance.
And that's it. And he's kind of like Will Keane. It's interesting. Will Keane obviously could have played for Ireland at underage years ago. He's obviously the twin brother of Michael Keane, who's centre back for Everton and in England international. And if you had gone back, say, he's 28 now, if you had gone back 10, 12, 14 years and said which of the Keane brothers would end up playing for Ireland, it would have been Michael, because he was in the Ireland setup. Will was the one who actually never came through. He went through all the age groups with Manchester United and was, I wouldn't say a golden boy, but he was one who seemed to be earmarked for getting through. He was all the development age groups with England up to the 21s. And then just injuries have, I can't say decimated his career, because he's still going. He's still forging a path, and he seems to have gotten someone behind, but he's had terrible problems with his knees. And obviously it was Mick McCarthy a couple of years ago who broached it with him, and he was the one who spoke to him and said, well, have you got interest in playing for Ireland? And he had. And it's taken him a while to actually find that fitness. I think he scored 4 goals in 9 games for, and it, I think what seems to have gotten the nods, maybe ahead of someone like, say, an Anthony Scully, who's in League One as well, and is flying with Lincoln and scoring and setting up, who tends to more so play off the left. He seems to be more someone who is that little bit, could be seen as a fox in the box, and as a player who, if a chance falls to him, could be capable of taking it. And as we've seen, and it's been... you could put this on repeat and just like say it, but like, since Robbie Keane has finished, we haven't had anyone capable of that. And like, even today, it's funny, the people saying, well, why isn't Shane Long in the squad? And you're like, come on, there's a time where you do have to move on, and you do have to kind of try something. You have to try something else a little bit, and you have to kind of see who else is out there that could actually, who can actually deliver. He's 28 years old. He's in a bit of form.
Let's give it a go.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Stay with us, David. We are going to take a very quick break. Bernard Jackman is outside the glass waiting to come in to talk about the URC.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Have your dinner ready in a flash with Green Fern's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet, available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Bernard Jackman has joined us in studio to talk about the URC. But before we get into that, Bernard, you are fresh from a Champions League trip. You went to see PSG and Man City. How was it?
Incredible. It's my son's birthday present, so we booked this about 2 months ago. Mad dash to get tickets, managed to pull 2 tickets out of the bag. And yeah, Messi's been injured the last couple of games, so when we arrived in the airport, we got a text saying he was fit to play, and then obviously to see him score his first goal was magic. Look, I don't know much about it, but Man City could have won the game, you know, 5-1 or 5-2. Man City had so many chances, but to see Mbappe, actually for me, Verratti was he was a standing player. I've never seen anyone as good as him, really. It was just an unbelievable occasion. PSG fans going absolutely mental when Messi scored his first goal, and for my young lad, it was just a great first Champions League game to go to. Yeah.
So look, I know you're a student of sport anyway, and there's so many people interested in the dynamic between the front three, Mbappe, Messi and Neymar. Could you see anything? Like, was the body language all good? Did they seem to all be getting on? Is it all happy in the camp?
No, look, I think Messi in fairness didn't track back at all. Like, I know very little about it, but I think tactically it's going to be hard for Pochettino, because he doesn't really have a midfield. I mean, Verratti and his other midfielder kind of helped the defence, and then you have 3 lads up front. Now, Mbappe is so quick, he can cover back the ground pretty quickly. Neymar, in fairness, was making an effort, but Messi, maybe his first game back, he was minding himself a little bit, well, but he never really went back into the opposition.
He's walking an awful lot more. So there's been so much online about how he's conserving his energy as much as he can so that he can maintain that explosive burst, a little bit like Ronaldo as well. They're not running around like they used to because they're not young anymore, so they're saving their energy a bit.
Yeah, he was doing that at Barcelona as well for the last few years, where you could do like the heat map or how much he's running. It's very, compared to some of his teammates, it's nothing, but it's Messi, so that's what I mean, he has that moment of skill.
He can stroll around
and
for
just genius
a
bit. He is one of the, him and Ronaldo are essentially the two players who are able to have as passengers because you know that we need a game.
As we've seen.
So Messi will knock one in from 40 yards still, or run from his own half and curl one in top corner, whereas Ronaldo was still the goat in the box, I suppose. Yeah. Totally different players.
Messi and magic and Ronaldo to the rescue. Yeah.
Just cherish them while they're here.
So, Bernard, the URC, it is up and going. We have our first weekend behind us. Just what was your thoughts on it in general?
Yeah, look, I thought it was... there's definitely more excitement about it. The fans seem to be buying into it. Obviously, unfortunately, the South African teams weren't really competitive. You know, the Lions beat Zeb, but yeah, we obviously, the Bulls and the Sharks were pretty unimpressive, really. And Munster and Leinster are top quality opposition, but they've certainly got work to do. Their box will come back, they will get better, they will adjust. But in general, I think there was some good attacking rugby played across the board, and it was a decent first round. You know, considering Leinster and Munster had only played one friendly each. They found their groove pretty quickly.
Yeah, you could tell that. But I suppose the reality, though, Bernard, is that there's an awful lot riding on the four South African teams eventually finding that bit of form and putting it up to everybody else in the league. Like, we kind of need that.
Yeah, we do. And I think they have a year's grace, to be honest, in terms of, obviously, next season, whoever wins that South African group goes into Champions Cup. So I think that post Christmas, now the worrying thing for them is, I actually watched the Sharks train this morning, and speaking to some of their coaches, they've had a, you know, they play Munster away, they go to Glasgow, then they go and play two Welsh teams, then they go home for a little while, and then it looks like it's nearly 100% certain now that their first batch of home games is actually going to be in Italy, in Treviso. So you know, these lads, they're away from family and friends for a long period, and obviously the home games for me was going to be really interesting to see how the Northern Hemisphere teams could go down there and win. If those home games are in Italy, you're going to have that mental fatigue, physical fatigue that the South Africans have without any home advantage. I think it could be very, very difficult for them. And it's just, I suppose, an insight into the challenges of this competition, with particularly for those South African teams who have to come over here, you know, for long periods at a time.
There are a lot of interesting subplots, though, already, you know, and I suppose Munster's probably the place to start when it comes to that. There's so many question marks over their coaching ticket. They want to stay, as we heard, because Larkin came out to the media this week and has got out early and said that they do want to stay on. Their contracts are up in the summer. But with that hanging over, I suppose everybody now, like, it is a question that's going to keep getting asked until they either decide to pin them down or decide that they're not pinning them down. Do you think that the right thing to do is for that coaching ticket to stay?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I think Munster should hold off, to be honest. I don't see what the rush is. I mean, Johan has been there 5 years. I think he's very steady. He's a good man. But Munster should be judging themselves on silverware. And I think, let's not forget, the end of the season, they messed up that Rainbow Cup. That was there for the taking. So it's probably the softest cup they're ever going to get, and they didn't capitalise on it. Also, it's interesting, is this coaching team didn't come together. Like, effectively, if Johan and the defence coach who came together, and then Graham and Stephen Larkham have been put in place. So it may be a case of you decide to separate them again and actually let, you know, maybe somebody else, maybe one of the assistants to build his own team, if they are going to make a change. Look, I think stability is important. We know Johan is very popular in the IRFU, but I don't see why a club like Munster would rush to sign coaches just because they want to stay if they're not 100% sure that they're going to bring them silverware. And that's where Munster should be at, and unfortunately there's been a lack of silverware.
Stability is important off the pitch. an identity is important on the pitch. And again, like, that's another part of this narrative that's been formed around Munster and that kind of battle to control the game plan and even just to discover what the game plan is. It is kind of a hangover from last season, really. What direction are they going in? What should they be doing? Should they be trying to evolve their game plan or doing what they do best as a Munster team? What do you think they should be doing?
Well, look, I think they need to evolve because they don't have the power to play the big teams at their own game. So they do need to have a plan B. You know, we're led to believe that Stephen Larkham is now effectively the head coach. He's doing a lot more coaching. Johan has stepped away to be more of a director of rugby. So the problem with that is you'll see a shift, but you're only starting that shift now. Whereas obviously, you know, they've had 5 years with Johan, obviously a year with Stephen to try and build that. But look, they need to start it. It looked like it was starting on Saturday night. There was lots of errors, there was lots of inaccuracies, but that's normal, to be honest, in terms of trying to build something new. I think for Munster to win a European Cup, they have to have, as I said, other strings to their bow. And unfortunately, there's pain in terms of trying to develop that. And that's going to be something that's going to be difficult for Munster fans to swallow if it becomes a long period of development.
They have a lot of the core ingredients, though, and like, two of those are players with X Factor, which is a fit Joey Carberry and Simon Zeebo doing what Simon Zeebo does.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, look, and they've Craig Casey now, you know, nipping at the heels of Conor Murray. RG Snyman's going to be like a new signing. I think Gavin Coombs is effectively like a new signing, even though he burst through last year, because now he's confirmed as an international number 8. And then you have Zeebo back, who's just a try-scoring machine. So they have a lot of capabilities. They've still got Keith Earls, you know, they've Chris Farrell, Damien Delande, David Kilcoyne. They are stacked, and that's why I think we should be expecting them to win silverware. I think it's they have the squad, the fairness to the board, they've invested in the talent, they've kept their best talent, they've invested in the coaches. Those coaches would be expensively put together. So yeah, they've got a great home crowd, the fans are back. Munster should be there or thereabouts.
So they have the Stormers on Saturday. Leinster then have the Dragons on Sunday at 2:00. And just given what we've seen from them already, it does look like they're just starting as they mean to go on.
Yeah, absolutely. And Johnny Sexton was on fire last week, and they have an unbelievable squad. They were really worried about the Bulls. They rated the Bulls. They watched the Bulls footage in the Currie Cup, so they were expecting an incredibly tough game, and they blew them away. So now, you know, you would say, oh, will there be a little bit of a dip? But historically, Leinster in this competition have just every week just got better and better and better. And no matter who they pick, it's probably too early for them to rotate. So I think that they'll go to Wales, and it's a big ask for the Dragons to beat Leinster even at home.
Connacht are an interesting one already. Amrone a week in, and I know you wrote about it in your column in the Sunday Independent last week, just saying that everybody needs a good, strong Connacht, the IRFU, the provinces themselves, just Irish rugby in general. So Andy Friend has made 3 changes to his starting side after the disappointment of the first week out. They're playing the Bulls. Is it too early to be worried, do you think?
No, it's not too early to be worried, but I think this game will be massive for them in terms of making the sports ground a fortress, beating the Bulls at a time when the Bulls are adjusting to this competition. You know, the problem for Connacht is this year there's very few clashes with internationals, so they won't get those softer points, you know, in November in the Six Nations that historically they've been able to pick up. Also, the competition criteria qualification for Europe is much more difficult. So Connacht are in the European Cup this year, which again is going to demand their frontline players to play on those 3 weekends at least that they play in the Champions Cup, and that's more difficult than the Challenge Cup. So it's stacked against them. Their attitude and their culture and their training and everything is spot on. I just feel to take 10% off their budget is going to have a bigger impact than it did off Munster, Ulster, or Leinster, because they're already starting from a lower base, and yet the competition has changed, the competition structure has changed. It'll be a miracle if they can pull off European Cup qualification on this budget, and I know the IRFU will expect them to and hope that they can pull it off, but I just think logically and realistically it's probably going to be a step too far, and we're better off funding them to keep them in the Champions Cup, and when they go into their new stadium have that I suppose, prestige of Champions Cup rugby, to be able to sell season tickets, to be able to sell sponsorship, corporate boxes, etc., which would eventually make them more better self-financing than they are.
But Andy Friend has still managed to make some exciting signings, though.
He did, but he's shopping in the bargain basement. You compare Dwayne Vermeulen coming to Ulster. You compare Orgie Snyman, Damien Delande to the player that... Look, I'm not talking... Andy Friend has done a great job in terms of people he's recruited, but they're not box office. They're not proven world-class players like the other provinces are able to do. And that's a risk. And you know, you will get it right every so often, but also you get it wrong. And when they get it wrong... So like Abraham Papali'i, he's a great player, but he was a rugby league player who had fitness issues that they had to get in, get him fit, teach him the game, etc., etc., etc. You get Dwayne Vermeulen, you roll him out week one, and you know what you're going to get.
Fifita is making his debut tomorrow in that game against the Bulls, so it'll be interesting to see how he gets on. For Ulster, tame enough game coming up against Zebra?
Yeah, look, at Zebra got beaten by the Lions, who are the worst South African province franchise. Ulster, even though it's away, we'll blow them away.
Okay, Bernard Jackman, thank you so much for coming in to join us, and more importantly, for giving me all those notes on that PSG game, because as everybody knows, because I keep talking about, I am heading over there soon enough. David Snaid as well, thank you so much for joining us. There are plenty of games on in the Europa League. I suppose the one that will be of interest to everybody at the moment is the Leicester game. It's half time there, David, I think.
Yeah, it is. Sorry, I just got a bit of team news there that Matt Doherty is starting for Spurs, so that's some good news for Ireland.
Yeah, because you were wondering beforehand. I'm trying to find the score of the Leicester game and
I think it was
1-0.
Yeah.
Right, we have our FIFA winner. I'll let you look for that score there, David. I have the winner of FIFA 22. So the question was, which player scored a last-minute winner for Manchester United last night? And it was Ronaldo. And the winner is Linda Dunn from Portlaoise in Leash. And Leicester are losing to Legia Warsaw. Okay, that is our lot. David, thank you so much. We'll be back tomorrow looking ahead to a very busy weekend of sport.
Green Farm. Get back on track after summer with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet range. Available in selected stores nationwide.